Inshallah ta'ala, we'll continue from where we left off last week in the tafsir of Surah Al-Talaq, and we completed the first page of that surah, and today inshallah ta'ala we'll start with the second page of it. There is a slim possibility that we actually get through the full page. It's very connected, but I've never actually come through with any of my promises regarding that before, so don't hold me to it. Surah Al-Talaq is not the final surah, but the before the final surah within this juz'ah, which is also a cluster, a group of surahs from Mujadala to At-Tahrim. And this group of surahs is all about organization. It talks about organizing the Muslim society or Muslim community. It looks at different aspects of organizing Muslim behavior in groups, as individuals, with spouses, with fellow Muslims, with citizens, with non-Muslims, with those who are your enemies, with those who have betrayed you, with those who are hypocrites, who aren't carrying their weight, with your leadership, with your society itself. So every surah talked about a different example, and I went through those examples throughout the last 7 to 7 months or so. And Surah Al-Taghabun, in the middle of them all, was a surah that just reminded us of why we're doing all of this, organizing the intention for us, and organizing the collective why, or the collective purpose of why of why we do what we do, and why it is that we commit to anything that we commit to. And Surah Al-Talaq talks about organizing family, or spouses, relationships among spouses. Family is going to be talked about in Surah Al-Tahrim, which is what will start probably, if not next week, the week after, which is the final surah within this cluster. But Al-Talaq talks about marriage, and talks about relationships within marriage. And the reason that it's going to talk about this topic by talking about Talaq is because Talaq is the worst case scenario. The worst thing that can happen within a marriage is for it to end in divorce, obviously. There's worse things as in abuse, but these aren't seen as marriage problems. They're seen as legal problems. Like, when you talk about domestic abuse, it's really, you can call it domestic abuse, but it's abuse. And abuse is abuse, and someone who is abusing someone else needs to be taken to a court of law and then held accountable for that. So Islam doesn't really look at that as its own entity. Really, it looks at marriage as an institution where you have rights and you have obligations, and there is a basis for what the relationship is built upon, and then the reason why this relationship may cease to exist altogether as well. When we talk about domestic abuse, or someone is abusing someone else, that doesn't necessarily fall under the context of marriage, Islamically speaking. It falls under the context of dhulm or udwan, of transgression or mistreatment, where the person, whether they're your husband or your wife or not, is going to be held to the same laws of the land that will apply to them if they are mistreating someone. And a lady, just as I, you know, for the sake of this piece of information, a woman was to go to a Muslim judge back in the day and show that she had a bruise anywhere in her body, that she was hit by her man, he will put him in jail. He will put him in jail. And that is simple Islamic 101 historical judiciary system, like the simple of jurisprudence. If a lady goes and says "darabni," and she shows any form of evidence, meaning he leaves any bruise of any sort, like any actual evidence on her body, he goes to jail. The verses that talk about fadribuhunna, what that means, has no space in when he actually strikes her physically to leave any form of a mark on it. That's not what these verses are talking about at all. And we know that because that's how the Islamic judicial system carried its verdicts and rulings all throughout the history of the Amawi, Abbasi, and Uthmani Khilafah. And you can just go back and read these things if you're interested in understanding them a little bit more. So that's, but in marriage itself, and I told you at the beginning of every session, I'll talk a little bit about certain aspects of marriage and what is required within it. And I covered a little bit as much as I could, at least, what the rights and the obligations are of spouses when they enter into this union. The man is by default the protector provider. He's always the protector. You can't take that away. There's no clause in a contract of marriage that will take that piece away. You're a man, you're a protector. She can say she doesn't want it. It doesn't matter. You're still the protector. That's how it's going down. If someone breaks into the house, you go down. She stays upstairs. You're the one who's going to die that night. They'll be the first to expire if someone's going to expire that night. That's how it is. Even if she wants to take that clause out of the contract saying, I don't need a protector, it doesn't matter. If she's asking for that, you probably shouldn't marry her to begin with. But that's what you're obligated to do under Islamic law. As a man, you're responsible for the safety of the women in your family, whether it's your mother, your daughter, your sister, your aunt, your grandmother, your granddaughter, or your niece, or your wife, obviously, which is your highest priority. You're responsible for her well-being. Period. And all of the rulings that you find in Islam that today are used to point out mistreatment of women, it comes from just this very simple concept that you're responsible for their protection. When these rulings are misused, they can turn into ways of limiting people's participation in life. Meaning, men are not allowed to use their position as protectors to control women's ability to participate in life and to live life. Because she's in the mahram doesn't mean that you get to control how she's going to live her life altogether. No, this is an aspect of you figuring out a way for her to be safe of where she's going, because she has a family and that's your job. So this is it's a family matter, and it has to be seen and run as such. Not that that's necessarily attached to marriage, but to some degree it is, because one of the aspects of the dynamic of marriage, and I thought bringing this up may be of benefit, is that when in Islam men and women marry, there's always, and especially today, there's always this lack of clarity. Well, what do I have to ask his permission for? This is this question I get a lot from this: is what do I have to ask his permission for? Anything that is a reasonable safety hazard, you have to run it, but you have to bring it to the intention of your husband. You have to bring it to his attention so he can decide how we're going to go by these things. That's what you have to bring by your husband. It's best that the details of this aspect is discussed before marriage, especially the daily ones, especially the daily aspects of what is considered a safety hazard and what isn't. So this discussion should happen before marriage, not after. If you don't have this before marriage, then you are very naive. Both of you are very naive. And you go back to the urf. So it doesn't default to what the man wants. It defaults to the urf, to the norm, to what is considered to be a safety hazard versus not amongst the norm of people. And you go back to the qadi, or you go back to the imams to kind of establish that. But if you don't want to do that, you actually have a discussion with your significant other before marriage. For example, in certain places of the world, men aren't comfortable with their wives going outside of the neighborhood on their own. And I lived in a place where that was actually a reasonable thing to ask for. Like, I lived in a place and a time where that was reasonable. Where when she leaves without a mahram this area, she is not safe anymore. Like, she can be abused and mistreated by people, so it's not safe for her to go. And that's an example where she has to make sure that she takes permission from the husband, and the husband provides either protection or they provide some way where she gets to go and he is there out of his own time to make sure that she's protected. Or she goes with a group of women, for example, or she goes with another mahram. There has to be some agreement. For example, living here in this city, the norm is that, no, a lady can move around the city very freely, very safely. It's not a risk hazard for her to go out the house and go to a mall or drive a car within the city, right? What about outside the city? What about that is not agreed upon. So if you go to the urf or the norm is that she's safe anywhere in Canada, basically, to move around. But the husband can point out that I'm not comfortable you on the 401, the highway of death. I'm not comfortable you on there alone, and I'm not comfortable going to drive. I don't want that. That has to be established beforehand. Like, before we get married, you have to establish that I'm not comfortable with that. And she has to be okay with that or not before they get married. Where he's going to be okay, I'm not going to be okay with you. She may be someone who's going to have to commute every day to a different city because that's the nature of her work, for example. So these things have to be agreed upon. But when the husband establishes with reasonable evidence that where you're going is not safe for a lady to be there alone, he's not ruled by law, or there is a high incidence of mistreatment, then she has to actually, you're not allowed as a woman to go without a mahram or without that. So for example, if my wife decides today she's going to go to Syria or to Gaza, right? I can say, no, you're not going. You know, I have the right as a husband to hinder that and say, no, you can't go. Well, then if I'm able to provide a mahram for her, myself or someone else, then yes. If not, then she shouldn't be going. This is important pieces within marriage. The issue is not that the man gets to control when you leave the house. That's not a part, even though that may be the culture in certain parts of the world. That's not actually what Islamic law is about. The man does not get to control where she gets to go. But he does get a say when there is a risk hazard involved in order for him to be able to protect her. So if he feels like you're going to a place where you're not safe and I can't protect you, then she has to listen to that. And if she feels that his standard for that is not reasonable, then that you either that is talked about before marriage and agreed upon or disagreed upon, or you bring it to the imam and the qadi or the judge actually offers what the norm is of that time. And the urf when it comes to marriage is very important. When people don't talk about things, you default. You default to Islamic law, you default to urf. And sometimes Islamic law defaults you to the norm. What's the norm? What is considered reasonable amongst the majority of functional couples within that area? And that usually is found out by or is known to the imams or the people who hear the questions that are involved in the ongoing. I think it's not really imams today. I think it's probably marriage counselors or divorce lawyers. I think they're the ones who can offer the most insight on what exactly people agree upon versus what they don't agree upon. But a lot of the laws that exist in Islam are not designed for a woman to, when she gets married, loses her freedom, or she goes from the dictatorship of a father to a dictatorship of a husband, but rather she goes from the protection of one person to the protection of someone else. And you can argue that maybe she doesn't need it, and you would be wrong, and that would be a very dumb argument, and I'm not going to actually entertain that at all. Because in the world that we live in, there's always some degree of need of protection for any human being. Actually, we all need protection, men included. It's just men don't get it. I'm just not offered that protection. I have to figure it out and protect myself, and if I don't, then I die, and that's my problem. But you are obligated as a man to protect the women in your life, and the women are obligated to accept that protection within what is considered to be reasonable. So spouses, before they get married, should have these discussions. What are you comfortable with? What are you not comfortable with? So that we have clarity, so that there's not a big point of dispute. Because if there's a big point of dispute, it becomes hard to live. Either she feels that this is not reasonable, there's no safety hazard here, I've been doing this for a long time, I don't see why this is not acceptable and why he's making a big deal. Or the opposite, she is doing something for him, he is always worried, he's always uncomfortable. No, neither of these people should feel like that. You should never be in a marriage where you feel that way. Because when it comes to protection, this is subjective, it's not objective. There aren't rules Islamically, this is what you're allowed to, no, this is subjective. This is going to be based on norm, culture, what people are accustomed to, and what their background is. So this may differ. Some men may be more comfortable with certain things and others may not. Women will have the same thing. A woman also has the right to say, I'm not going, I need to go this place. I'm not going because I'm not safe. You need to either provide a mahram or come with me. And I have the right to go here. So he has to go. For example, if she's going to visit her family or if she has an appointment somewhere that, for her health, for example. So that he has to go and he has to provide a mahram. And she's like, I'm not comfortable going to this part of the city alone. I need someone there. He is obligated to offer some degree of protection, one way or the other. Now, understanding that the Prophet ﷺ's vision for the world would be the day where a va'ina, meaning a lady on a camel, would leave Iraq to perform Hajj alone. This is in Bukhari Muslim, where he ﷺ envisioned the time when a lady would leave Iraq on her camel alone to go perform Hajj and come back with no mahram and not fearing for her own safety. So he envisioned that he saw in a time where it'd be safe, where law would rule, and where people could move around safely, and a woman wouldn't need protection. So the concept of mahram and protection is based on necessity, based on the necessity, not based on control. The idea here is not to give the man the ability to control her movement. No, that's not what the purpose of these rulings are, is to keep her safe. And I don't think I need to explain why that's a very important thing. Because one breach of that one example of a breach where a woman is not safe and she does get, then it's not worth it. It's not worth running the risk of that happening one time, because this type of experience is life scarring. It ruins life completely. Islam is very strict on that, making sure that this does not happen. That we do whatever we have to do to make sure this does not occur to a woman in any sense or form. Which is why these rulings are there. So that's a piece of, I just wanted to add that because I didn't talk about that last time. But the man is a protector, provider. That is the default of Islam. You can always default to that. A woman at any point in her life in marriage, if she's working, can say, I'm done. Where's the house? I'm stuck in here. Go work. Dabbir halak. I don't care. Sell a kidney, you work three jobs, I don't care. You'll go provide, I'm not working. I'm staying in the house, I'm taking care of the kids, I'm taking care of the household. She has the right to do it anytime, right? And the husband, who may take on certain any responsibilities within the household, can always default and say, nope, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to be focused just to providing and protecting, I'm not going to do this piece anymore. So you can always default to these things. However, you can always have an agreement at the beginning of marriage of the provision, 50-50, and the housework and the household maintenance, 50-50. That's totally fine. Islamically, there's nothing wrong with that. There's no right or wrong answer here. It's just that it's allowable to always default. It's allowable to all of you. If the man defaults and says, I'm not doing my 50% in terms of the household, then the woman pulls her 50% of what she's contributing to the household in terms of finance. And she uses that 50% to supplement whatever is left in terms of the household. It works out either way. It works out either way. Like if I'm doing 50%, I'm working, I'm putting all the money in the bank account, all of my money. And she's putting all of her money, and it's the same amount. We're making the same, right? So it's 50-50 in the bank account that we're all pulling out to take care of ourselves. She's doing 50% of the housework. I'm doing 50% of the housework. At one point, she's like, I'm not contributing 50% of my money anymore. She takes her money out, puts it in her own account. She can do that anytime. And the household continues to be taken care of through the amount of money that she can do that anytime she wants. But he has the right at that point also to pull out his 50% of what he's doing in the house. He doesn't have to take care of the household in terms of work. I'm not talking about wealth. It's your wealth that is going to be spent to take care, to clothe and feed and maintain the household. I'm talking about work. For example, the time that I spent with the children at home, the cooking, the cleaning, the maintenance, that type of work, you can divide it. A man can say at any point, I'm not doing any of this anymore. I'm not responsible for the household anymore. I'm going to be only outside. At that point, she doesn't have to contribute financially anymore to the household. So she holds on to her money. Well, the work is too much. Well, you can pay from your own money as a woman who's working for a maid or someone to come and help you with whatever's left. Honestly, it's a better deal for the lady. It's a better deal if he does that. Honestly, it's better. Like if a lady just keeps her own money to herself and uses whatever she needs to pay for someone to come and help with the housework, I think it's a better setup. I'm actually encouraging it. I'm encouraging it. All right? If you're working as a woman, hold on to your own wealth. Put it aside. Don't have a joint account. Make your own account. Put it alone. He has nothing to do with the household at all. Whatever money you make, you take care of the house, and you use your money to take care of whatever you don't have time to take care of. From your own wealth, you can bring someone to do it, right? And then he is responsible for taking care of you financially and the children and the household. Why? Because it just works better. It just works better. The number of messes that I've seen, because they're both working and putting the money together, it becomes very messy. And women tend, the wives tend to be much more disgruntled when their wealth is being put into, like when they feel that they are when that a lot of their wealth is being put in to the household where the man's wealth should have been put in, and he's controlling the money more than she is, even though she's contributing 50%, and it ends up starting a lot of bad feelings. And it begins, people start to drift away from one another. So I think it's a better way of it being done that way. You know, because when you hold on to your own wealth, if he needs money, he can ask, you can give, we keep track. We keep track. There's a Dane in the middle, you keep track. When you put it all into one mush, it's one big pot, you can't keep track anymore. People are putting money out, and he went and bought this is the joint bank account, we're all putting money in it. He went and bought an expensive car for himself. From whose money? Was it just from his money? Or was some of her money too? Does she own some of that car? How are we going to actually keep calculation of all this? And then things start to get messy. And then she does the same, and then it just gets ugly. So it's better if it's separated. Like I know people are like, no, we're in love. Babe, good, good. Have separate bank accounts. So you stay in love, inshallah. So you stay. It's okay. No, but I love him. I get it. Hold on to your money, and he can hold on to his. And then you guys help the household in ways where there's someone's keeping track of things. So it's fair. Because Islam sees that the working outside and bringing the money in to take care of the household financially, clothe, feed, and protect, is equal to the work that is required to maintain the household. That's why. Because Islam sees them to be equal. Like the woman staying home, cleaning the house and doing the laundry and cooking the food and taking care of the children, that is equal to all the work that you're doing outside. Islamically, they're the same. You don't come home and say, what are you doing? No, she's been working probably equally or more than you are. It's the same thing, right? Because that makes it clear in terms of what the responsibilities are. And that clarity will help everyone function better. Because that way we're appreciative of one another. I see, Islamically, you're being told as a man, you see that the fact that she stayed home and took care of the house and took care of the kids, that is a job that you had to be grateful for because it's very hard. Just like you want her to be grateful for the 8 hours you spent with your boss spitting at you all day long and you stayed there so you get paid at the end of the month to bring a paycheck and take care of her. So it becomes an issue of gratitude. When there's no clarity in what the responsibilities and rights are, and it's one big mush, and no one knows that there's lack of gratitude, everyone starts thinking, I think I'm doing more. I'm probably putting more money, I'm doing more work. Everyone starts to think what they're putting in and what the other person is not putting in. And then it becomes an issue of who's working more and who's not pulling their weight, and it turns into something that's very negative and it goes in the wrong direction. You want to keep it positive, keep clarity of responsibilities and rights. All right. And that's just some advice on, you know, how to stay married if you want to. So we continue, inshallah, from ayah number 6. This whole surah is only 12 verses, not very long. And the fiqh ends at ayah number 7. Like the verses that have fiqh in them, that have rulings, end in the two verses we recite today, that's the end of the fiqh that exists in the surah. The rest of the surah is just a lot of warnings that you better follow these lessons properly or else you're going to be in trouble. And the reason that's the case, and I'm going to point out to you, inshallah, some degree of clarity over the next over this halaqah, next halaqah, is that what the norm was when these verses were revealed. So these verses that came and established very clearly what the rights are when it comes to divorce. Let's start from the beginning, just to go through them quickly. So first of all, the talaq has to happen, فَطَلِّقُوهُنَّ لِعِدَّتِهِنَّ. And it has to happen, and there has to be someone who oversees this. يَا أَيُّهَا النَّبِيُّ. If it's not the Prophet ﷺ himself, it's a judge. Someone has to oversee this process. It's not something that happens that you can just socially figure out, do whatever you want. No, there has to be someone responsible. It has to happen at the right time. So it has to be a time of purity where no intercourse occurred. It can't happen during her menstruation period or during a purity where they've had intercourse. You have to wait until it's the beginning of a purity cycle and you have not had any. That's when you can perform the talaq if you're going to do it. Four times in the first page, he said, وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ رَبَّكُمْ in different ways. I'm not going to point that out because it's all throughout the page where he keeps on saying, وَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهَ. And he actually does a lot of explanation. Like, it's not where he just a quick taqwa. No, a full explanation. وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهَ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهَ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مِنْ أَمْرِهِ يُسْرًا وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهَ يُكَفِّرْ عَنْهُ سَيِّئَاتِهِ وَيُعْظِمْ لَهُ أَجْرًا. He keeps on talking about if you just have taqwa because of the importance of doing this in the right way, in the right method. She is not to be removed from her home when the divorce happens. She stays in her home for the time unless she performs a fahisha during that time. In that case, she can be removed. Otherwise, she stays in her home. You leave. If the house is not designed where you can live separate within the same space, and it's just an apartment and it's all open, if you perform the divorce, you get out. She stays for the iddah for the time being, right? And then when the time ends at the end of the third three cycles, you have to make a decision. Either you reunite and it's considered that you made one talaq, but you just reunite with nothing. You don't require anything but two witnesses, or you end the marriage. And the marriage ends, you need witnesses for that as well. Now, once the marriage ends, after you can only get married to this lady with a new mahr. Like you have to remarry all over again, as if you guys were never married before. Right? If the three cycles of the iddah ends, and you guys don't reunite, you don't decide to go back together again, then this is considered a divorce. You're done, you're divorced. But you're like, I wanna get together again. Then you have to go and ask for her hand from her parents all over again. And you have to do a full mahr and a full nikah. The whole thing has to happen all over again because you didn't do it within the period of the iddah. And you can only do that twice. So if someone divorces and they spend the three cycles and they don't come back together, a full divorce occurred, right? That's strike one. He wants to get married again. They want to get married again. He goes, he asks for her hand. They do another nikah, another mahr, another everything, right? They're married, they divorce. And a full cycle goes over and it happens. Now strike two. And if they want to marry again, they have to go through the process again, a third time, where they have to go do mahr and nikah. But this time, if they divorce, that's it. This time, if they divorce, then it's khalas, we're done. Now, you can't really get back together unless you go. You guys have to go get, live your own lives. She has to go live, get married again, and then somehow be, you know, divorced or be widowed or something. And then, so like later in life, if you guys want to come back together, you can try it again, but not immediately after, because you've already established that you are immature, you are not compatible, and you're not getting it, making it work, and you're causing yourselves and other people a lot of agony, and this is a ridiculous cycle that should not continue to happen. So it's twice, and then the third time, khalas, everyone goes in their own direction. And then you need proper witnesses, because divorce, as marriage, should be a decision, not a moment of anger, right? No one gets angry and finds themselves married. And no one gets passionate for a moment and finds themselves married. No, it shouldn't happen for divorce. You shouldn't, at a moment of passion, find yourself divorced. No, you decide to get married and you decide to get divorced. You need the proper, it's a aqd to enter and it's a aqd to get out. So it's a contract to get into marriage. It's not a very complicated one. Just two people. The least important person in the room at the time is the sheikh. Yeah? The least important person at the time of marriage is the sheikh. You don't need him at all. He's completely useless. He is not important at all. You just need the groom, the father of the bride, and two witnesses. That's it. Everyone else is just hashu. You're just people filling up spaces. They're MPRs. They don't mean anything in the whole game. The imam specifically is completely, he's just there to document. He's not important. You don't need a sheikh to officiate your marriage. You just need to do this, Islamically speaking. Obviously, you have to go down to city hall and do the whole, run around. But Islamically speaking, that's all you require. And then he pointed out, though, what is the iddah for those who don't have those who are postmenopausal, or those who have never had a cycle, then it's 3 months. It is full 3 months is their iddah. If they're postmenopausal, so they don't have cycles, or they never had a cycle in their life, then it's going to be 3 months. And if someone is hamil, if they're pregnant, then the iddah is until the end of their pregnancy. Whether the end of their pregnancy is in 12 hours or whether the end of their pregnancy is in 9 months, it doesn't make a difference. So their period of iddah for someone who's pregnant is going to be until the termination or the end of their pregnancy. Whether that is a couple of days because she's at the end of her pregnancy, or it's close to a year because she's at the beginning of her pregnancy, it doesn't make a difference. All right, so those are the rulings of fiqh that have been explained so far. We're going to go through ayah number 6 and 7. I'll tell you why these rulings are explained and why the word taqwa came so many times once we're finished ayah number 7. Then we'll recite the verses after that are spiritual and there as warnings for all of us, and I'll tell you why, inshallah. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. أسكنوهن من حيث سكنتم So beware, من حيث سكنتم من وجدكم. وجدكم. So the جيم is ساكن and the واو has a ضمة. It's not very comfortable to say a واو with a ضمة on it. و. مِن وُجَدِكُمْ, right? مِن وُجَدِكُمْ, that's how it's supposed to sound.
وَلَا تُضَارُّوهُنَّ لِتُضَيِّقُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ.
Because the ayat are talking about women and their rights and their rulings, you have the noon and niswa a lot at the end of the words. So لا تضاروهن, the noon here is to refer to ladies. لتضيقوا عليهن, again for ladies. So عليهم works for men and men and women. عليهن with the noon, right? That means only women. So in Islam, whenever the rulings are specific for sisters, you'll have the noon and niswa repeated. That's why Surah Al-Talaq is filled with this, because a lot of the rulings here are specific for sisters and women in Islam.
وَإِن كُنَّ أُولَاتِ حَمْلٍ فَأَنْفِقُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ.
So when you see the word أُولَاتِ, you see on the waw, right? You see on the waw a circle. So that circle tells you that the letter under it is never recited, or is never pronounced within our recitation, at least within Hafsan al-Asim. These signs, the circle on top of the well, these are signs that were added later on. They weren't within the mushaf that the Sahaba wrote. Just like a lot of the letters on a lot of the dots on the fa and the qaf and the ta and the noon, they didn't exist because the Arab didn't require any of these things to recite Arabic appropriately. They're added here to make it easier for يعني modern Arabs and non-Arabs to recite يعني and understand how to do it well. So the wow there, because the for our recitation for حفص عن عاصم من طريق الشاطبية, we don't pronounce it. We say وإن كنا أولاتي أولاتي. We don't say أولاتي. We don't give a wow. We just a ضمة. There's other recitations that may have that in them, but ours doesn't. And the way you know that we don't is by that by that circle on top of the waw to tell you what under it is not pronounced when you recite. All right. حتى يضعن حملهن
فإن أرضعن لكم فآتوهن أجورهن. وَأْتَمِرُوا بَيْنَكُمْ بِمَعْرُوفٍ وَإِنْ تَعَاسَرْتُمْ فَسَتُرْضِعُ لَهُ أُخْرَى. لِيُنْفِقَ ذُو سَعَةٍ مِّن سَعَتِهِ وَمَنْ قُدِرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقُهُ فَلْيُنْفِقْ مِمَّا آتَاهُ اللَّهُ لَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا مَا آتَاهَا سيجعل الله بعد عسر يسرا.
So the explanation of the verses here. أسكنوهن من حيث سكنتم من وجدكم. أسكنوهن is mean put them in a place to live. من حيث سكنتم من وجدكم. الوجد هو السعة والطاقة, meaning wujd is your ability. من حيث سكنتم, so have them live in a place that is similar من حيث سكنتم to where you live in general. من وجدكم, to the extent of your ability to put them in. So when divorce happens, they either stay in the house that they're living in, or they have to live in a house that is similar to the one that you are living in. Because sometimes, like I said, the financial agreement is that you're both putting into this home. And once the divorce happened, it breaks. So you can't pay the rent for this specific space anymore. But you still have to keep her in a proper house for the duration of the iddah. For the duration of the iddah, she has to stay there. So if it's not going to be in this house, it has to be a house that is similar to where you or your family is living to the extent of your ability. مِن وُجِدِكُمْ, to whatever it is you can bring forward. You're not required to meet a standard that you don't have the money to pay for, but you can't put her in a yani in a garbage can and decide, well, that's why I can only afford this, you know, this slum somewhere down where no one lives. No, you have to put her in a place that is similar to where you're living in terms of space and safety and also luxury. So it has to be similar. If the space that she's living in is not for her and you don't want to leave. So if the man doesn't want to leave the home for reasons, sometimes that house is where he does his work, for example, or this is the, I mean, he can't get out of the house, then he's responsible for putting her in a space that is similar to the one that she was living in before or similar to the one that you are living in to the extent of your ability to do so, right? وَلَا تُضَارُّهُنَّ. تُضَارُّهُنَّ comes from the root of ضَرَر. ضَرَر is harm. وَلَا تُضَارُّهُنَّ, I mean do not cause harm to them. لِتُضَيِّقُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ, to make it more difficult for them to survive. التضيق is to make things slim or make things uncomfortable. Why this is being explained? Because men would use the fact that they were the sole breadwinners back then to make it extremely difficult for the ladies to survive throughout their iddah as a way of getting back. As I said, a lot of divorces don't usually happen because people are happy together and that they like each other a lot. No two people who are, you know, in love and happy decide to divorce. It's usually they're not getting along, so there's some resentment that's going on. So men would use their wealth to make it difficult. So they remove their wives from their homes, and they wouldn't give them their nafaqah for the time of the iddah. Or if they did, they would give them a very small amount, not enough to live in a place that is respectful or similar to the one that they were living in before. So this verse is saying, أَسْكِنُهُنَّ مِنْ حَيْثُ سَكَنْتُمْ مِنْ وُجْدِكُمْ. You put them in a house to live in that is similar to the one that you're living in to the extent of your ability. وَلَا تُضَارُّهُنَّ. Do not harm them or cause harm to them with the intention of trying to make it difficult for them to survive over whatever money that you're giving them. Trying to get them to leave or to, you know, to give up on what their rights are. وَإِن كُنَّ أُولَاتِ حَمْلٍ. And if they are pregnant, فَأَنْفِقُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ حَتَّى يَضَعْنَ حَمْلَهُنَّ. Then you're going to continue to take care of them financially until they give birth. Why is this here? You just talked about that a second ago. Because what is the iddah, generally speaking, that was explained to us? It's going to be ثَلَاثَةْ قُرُوءْ, right? Three cycles. If the postmenopausal or no menstruation, 3 months. But what if the lady is second month of pregnancy? Then the iddah is going to be 7 months, right? So is the man only responsible for the first three? No, he's responsible for the full duration of the pregnancy. So that's why this verse is here. So you're responsible for all 7 months. It's not just three, because, well, that's the longest. No, you're responsible حَتَّى يَضَعْنَ حَمْلَهُنْ, until they give birth to whatever they're carrying in their bellies. So that's the first piece of fiqh here. And this is simple. I don't have to give you different madhahib and what they agree upon or they talk about, because this is technically mostly agreed upon amongst all four schools of jurisprudence, that the man is responsible to put his wife in a house. If he's not going to leave her in the home that they were married in for some reason, because he's supposed to leave, as the verses at the beginning said. But if he can't, meaning he needs to stay in this home for personal reasons, then he has to put her in a house that is similar to the one that he's living in to the extent of his financial ability. And he's not allowed to use his wealth and to use the nafaqah as a way to harm or to lessen the amount of money he gives her, or to hold back or to be late on payments to make her life difficult. Like that, someone will follow up on that. And he's responsible for her nafaqah, he's responsible for her financially until she gives birth to her child, even if it's more than the iddah, even if it's more than the 3 cycles or 3 months that the verses before talked about. All right, the second piece, فَإِنْ أَرْضَعْنَ لَكُمْ. Now that they're divorced, if the mother decides to breastfeed the child, فَآتُوهُنَّ أُجُورَهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ, then فَآتُوهُنَّ أُجُورَهُنَّ, then you are responsible as a man to compensate her for that. Most schools of jurisprudence don't see this piece of the verse to be specific to divorcees, but rather in general, the man is responsible for the feeding of his child. Right? I'm responsible financially for feeding and clothing my child. The wife, the mother, is not. So if she breastfeeds, that's something that she's doing that she can be compensated for. The majority of madhahib, the majority, all three out of four schools of jurisprudence, see that the man must compensate his wife for the breastfeeding, meaning the nafaqah is a little bit higher. There's a little bit more nafaqah that goes into this. When they're divorced, for sure, there's no disagreement at all, that if she's going to breastfeed her child, he owes for that. And if she decides that she doesn't want to, then he has to go find someone who will. Like, he will pay for someone to take care of this child, or he'll pay for the... Back then, there was no formula, yani, which is better for them, but honestly, it's garbage. But yani, they would have to find someone who's willing to breastfeed the child for the child to survive. So he would have to... وَأْتَمِرُوا بَيْنَكُمْ بِمَعْرُوفٍ فَآتُوهُنَّ أُجُورَهُمْ, and you compensate her, you give her أجر for breastfeeding. وَأْتَمِرُوا بَيْنَكُمْ بِمَعْرُوفٍ, and decide what the amount is going to be amongst you by asking those who know about this. بِمَعْرُوف, meaning do it. This word ma'ruf keeps on coming up. Ma'ruf means with kindness, with good ethics, with ethics and morals that the society know to be good. Meaning continue to stay within the green lines of societal ethics. So وَأْتَمِرُوا بَيْنَكُمْ بِمَعْرُوفٍ, meaning figure out how this is going to work, what the amount is going to be, what the proper amount of compensation is. بِمَعْرُوفٍ, what is acceptable through norms and through what people are doing. وَإِن تَعَاسَرْتُمْ, and if you come to a dead end, meaning he is offering this much and the wife is like, I want more for doing this, they just don't agree. Sometimes this is going to happen, obviously, if there's a lot of resentment. فَسَتُرْضِعُوا لَهُ أُخْرَى, then he's responsible to pay someone else to breastfeed his child, or to pay for the formula, for example, that is going to be used.
لينفق ذو ساعة من ساعته.
This is a command. لينفق, the lam here is the lam of amr in Arabic. So it's a command. So may someone do this as a command to them. So لينفق, to spend. لينفق ذو ساعة. ذو ساعة, the one who is comfortable. من ساعته, from the comfort of his finances. لينفق, may the man who is comfortable spend from the comfort of his wealth. Meaning, you are going to spend upon your wife not a specific amount, but a percentage that makes sense to your comfort of wealth. This is what this ayah is explaining. It's not about a fixed amount. It's about how much money you have and what you're capable of providing for the person in front of you, and for your child, and for the person who's taking care of your child.
وَمَنْ قُدِرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقُهُ قُدِر, القدر,
قُدْرَ is ability or potency. قَدْر, or it means تَضِيق, meaning when something is less than something else.
مَنْ قُدِرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقُهُ,
and the one whose rizq, their provision, قُدِرَ عَلَيْهِ, has been lessened for them, I guess not a lot. And this is an important word to understand, because you'll find it like in the Quran a number of times. If you don't understand what it means, if you think it means potency or ability, you'll recite something and you'll completely misunderstand it. For example, in Surah Al-Fajr, فَأَمَّا الْإِنسَانُ إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ رَبُّهُ فَأَكْرَمَهُ وَنَعَمَهُ فَيَقُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمًا وَأَمَّا إِذَا مَبْتَلَاهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ فَقَدَرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقَهُ, he lessened his provision for him.
وَذَنُّونِ إِذْ ذَهَبَ مُغَاضِبًا فَظَنَّ أَلَّا نَقْدِرَ عَلَيْهِ فَنَادَى فِي الظُّلُمَاتِ أَلَّا إِلَهَ إِلَّا أَنْتَ سُبْحَانَكَ إِنِّي كُنْتُ مِنَ الظَّالِمِينَ.
وذنون, meaning the man of the whale. He's speaking to, talking about Jonah or Yunus alayhi salam.
إِذْ ذَهَبَ مُغَاضِبًا,
when he went away in a state of anger. فَظَنَّ, and he thought, أَلَّا نَقْدِرَ عَلَيْهِ, that we would not, نَقْدِرَ عَلَيْهِ. So if you understand naqdir here as an ability, then the verse means and he thought that Allah couldn't get him. That's insane. He's a prophet of God. Yani a kafir wouldn't think that. Yani someone who's a mushrik would knows that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has potency, he can capture him anytime he wants. For a prophet of God not think, and there's an old story here where Muawiyah and Abu Sufyan would come to the Habr al-Ummah, to the great scholar of our Ummah, Ibn Abbas, alayhi salam radiallahu anhu, who came to him and said, Ya Turjuman al-Quran. تلاطمتني أمواج القرآن البارحة فأسعفني. He said, oh, translator of the Quran for us, the waves of the Quran smacked me around last night, I didn't know what to do. So I told him, what is it? He said, أيظن يونس أن الله لن يقدر عليه. Yunus, the prophet of God, thinks Allah can't capture him. فقال ابن عباس هذا من القدر يا أمير المؤمنين لا من القدرة. This is from qadr, from lessening something, not from capturing or having sovereignty or ability over it. فَظَنَّ أَلَّا نَقْدِرَ عَلَيْهِ, and he thought that he was not going to be punished for it. He was not going to be lessened, his love and status was not going to be lessened because of the fact that he left his people in a state of anger. He left his people without permission. Prophets aren't allowed to leave the place Allah sends them without permission. He left when Allah told him that his people were going to be punished in 3 days. Khalas, punishment is coming. Like Lut alayhi salam told his people, like Hud told his people, like Salih, like Shu'aib. So he told his people that you're going to be punished, and he was so upset with them. It's like, yani, what idiots you are. I've been talking to you for years. You had to bring upon yourself punishment. And he left. He was like, I don't want to look at your faces anymore. Like, well, why would you do this to yourself? So he left out of anger because they wouldn't respond to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But he had no right to leave. Allah didn't tell him it's okay to leave. So he was punished and he was engulfed by the whale. But because of that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala extended the chance to his people. And فَأَرْسَلْنَاهُ إِلَى مِئَةِ أَلْفٍ أَوْ يَزِيدُونَ. He was sent back to the 100,000 people of Mosul, of Nainawa, and they all repented and they believed in him, alayhi salatu wasalam. So it worked for everybody. But I just wanted to give out the concept of qadr here. So, وَمَنْ قُدِرَ عَلَيْهِ رِزْقُ, the one whose rizq, their provision, are lessened for them. It's not high, it's lower. فَلْيُنْفِقْ, may they spend. مِمَّا آتَاهُ اللَّهُ, from whatever it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave them. لَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا
illa ma ataha. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not hold you accountable for more than what you were given. You can't give from what you were not given. It sounds like so. Sounds like it's common. It sounds like it's common sense, isn't it? Right? Yeah, it isn't. It isn't. Most people don't have. You can't give from something you weren't given. If you were not taught something, you can't teach it. If you don't know something, you can't practice it. If you understand something, you can't talk about it. Right? It's simple. If you know it, if you were taught it, if you understand it, if you were educated about it, you can give from it. It's common sense. If everyone followed this rule in life, like 90% of conversations wouldn't happen. 99% of disagreements and arguments wouldn't occur. If you don't know what you're talking about, just be quiet. You don't know what you're talking about. Just be quiet. Wallahi. Ya salam. Like, the world would be a much less noisy place. Like, the noise levels in the world just come down. You don't know what you're talking about. You didn't study this. Don't talk about it. Someone seems to be barking that they know, okay, I don't know much. I think they're wrong. But I don't know anything about this. I'll go find someone who does. You'll find someone who knows what they're talking about. With a few words, they silence the person who's barking about something they don't know. We're done. We don't need 50 people yelling. It doesn't do anything. Islam, for example, is not a topic of discussion, right? This is for my Arab friends. It's not something to discuss. Islam is something for you to learn. You can come and learn it. You don't sit around and discuss. Discussions happen amongst scholars. They sit down and they discuss, because just like you don't sit down and discuss medicine, you don't discuss Islam either, unless you are properly educated. I don't sit down and discuss the law. I don't talk about the legal. I don't know. I don't know anything. Who am I? Based on what? Am I going to sit down and talk about what is? I don't know. I can have questions. I can have pet peeves, but I don't have the ability to discuss this because I don't know it. Maybe if you don't come from an Arab background, this sounds weird to you. But let me speak about my Arab people. I am a physician and I am a sheikh. Like, no bragging. I sit within my family gatherings. They talk about medicine and they talk about Islam. I am never involved in those conversations, ever. They talk about it. No one is interested in asking me anything. Like, they'll sit down and take out all of their medicines. Oh, try this. They're all doctors, except the actual doctor. And they're all you, except the actual person who studied this. So, and I actually find it now amusing. It used to bother me when I was younger. I love it now. I actually say, please don't ask me. Go on. Where's the popcorn? Let's enjoy. At least, you know, make it fun. But there's this problem with our, where we want it to, I don't know if it's enthusiasm or, I don't know what it is, but people talk too much about things they don't really understand. Whether it's politics, whether it's the law, whether it's religion, whether it's medicine, whether it's almost anything. Look, learn things, educate yourself appropriately. Then go ahead and throw your hat in the, you know, in the arena and give your opinion on stuff. But if you have not been properly educated, find someone who knows what they're talking about and then, you know, refer to their opinion on the matter. Life would be much easier to live if that was the case. Much easier to live. Why? لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا ما آتاها. You're only responsible in your life for that which Allah gave you. Give from what you were given. Were you given this? No. Then don't give from it, because you don't have it to begin with. فَاقِدُ الشَّيْءِ لَا يُعْطِي. You don't have it, you can't give it. Maybe don't talk about it. Don't make things up as you go along. I sometimes watch people make things up. Like they walk up in the masjid to ask me a question, and I ask them, and they make something on the spot. And I think it's amazing because I can watch the swiftness of the human brain working quickly to patch. And they're getting smarter because they know now not to give numbers that are too round. Give numbers that are kind of broken. Give like 76.3%. It sounds more believable than saying 80 or 90, right? And they just pulled it out of their pocket. They just made that up. We became so good at this. 90% of Facebook, you'll find a Western study or a study from Harvard. Miskeen Harvard. Wallahi, miskeen Harvard. The number of studies the Muslims have decided that he has made, that this university has made, way more than the papers that they've actually made. Every time someone wants to prove something, there's a study from Harvard that just says, where's the study? Show me the study. I dare you to show me the study or anything close to it or any study from anyone across the world that talked about this. Never. It's just we need a way to make a point. You don't need to make points. Islam doesn't need that, by the way. Islam does not need you to make false points to convince people of anything. If you need to make false points to convince someone of the haqq, then it's not haqq. Then it's not haqq, or the way you understand it is not haqq. It could be haqq, but you don't get it.
Like, you don't get it yet. It's haqq, but you just don't understand it well. If you need to make something up or lie or exaggerate, yeah, to convince someone of something that is true, that either it's not true or you don't understand it to be true. Like, you don't, your comprehension of it is not truthful. It could be the truth, but you just don't understand it right. And that's important to kind of comprehend here. I know it's not much to do with this, but I find this ayah to be, like, Surah Al-Talaq is filled with wisdom. It's filled with wisdom. After each time, it gives us a very specific jurisprudent ruling. It gives us a little bit of wisdom. La yukallifu Allahu nafsan illa ma ata. You're only responsible, you're only accountable yawm al-qiyamah for that which you were given. What hand were you dealt? Just do well with that hand. Even though it may not win a lot more than, may not win as much as someone else's hand will win. But did you do your best with your hand? Like, did you play your hand to the best of your ability? Khalas, that's all you were ever asked to do. Ya akhi, that's all you were ever asked to do. You were never asked to have the best hand. You were just asked to do the best you can with what you were given. And if you're able to add to that, if you're able to be ambitious and move forward, go ahead and do that, but don't make things up and don't live outside of your means, and don't act like you are more than what you are. We all have to learn to be this. This comes from the simple comprehension of humbleness, really. Where you just don't try to impress. Why are you trying? Who are you trying to impress? Let me tell you this. No one is impressed. No matter what you do, no one is really impressed. Do you understand that people who are impressed by you are actually hoping that you fall at some point? Impressed, when you're impressed by someone, it's a reflex of weakness most of the time. Most of the time, not all the time. If the proper relationship is there of ilm and qurb min Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the proper relationship can be different. But most of the time, it's a feel of weakness where you couldn't beat them, even though you tried every trick in the book that you got. You couldn't prove to yourself that you're better. So you have to submit to the fact that they're better than you. So you don't want to actually say that, so you're impressed by them. But you're just hoping at some point that they slip and fall so that you don't have to feel that way anymore. So just stop the whole thing and just feel, look at things differently. And if you stop doing that, you stop trying to impress and try to be better and try to be ahead and try to be more than you are, you live a more healthy lifestyle. You stop, like, it's very tiring. It's very tiring to always be comparing and trying to, it's not helpful. And then you actually have the mental space and the mental clarity to look at someone who can help you, who can teach you, who can educate you, who can bring you closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and you can be impressed in a good way, as the Sahaba were impressed with the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Not like the munafiqeen were impressed by the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Some munafiqeen, they were impressed by him, but not for the right reason. They just couldn't beat him. So but the Sahaba who loved him, no, they saw him as their way to heaven. So they wanted to be like him. They wanted to, for him to fall would be a big problem. For him not to do as well would hurt them, would make them sad. لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا ما آتاها سيجعل الله بعد عسر يسرا. When it comes to money, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will make, after every difficulty, there will be ease. This is not a general law within life, right? Not every difficulty in life will be followed by an ease. Unless you call death ease, then yes. Sometimes, some difficulties are terminal. Some difficulties are terminal, you're going to die at the end of it. So, if you call death ease, then yes, this law applies. If not, really, it's more attached to the concept of what you were given. If you don't have a lot today, Allah will, life is a cycle. You don't have a lot today, you'll have a little bit more later. It doesn't stay like that. People who are functional, they don't stay poor all their lives. They get opportunities, they get, things change a little bit, they make money. So give from what you've got. This is what the ayah is saying. Give from what you've got. If you have a lot, give from the lot that you have. So give a lot because you have a lot. And if you don't, if you don't have a lot of provision, then give from that which Allah gave you. You are not required to give from more than what you have. Don't go take out loans. Like, if this is what you got, right? You give it. That's why, another point for marriage here, financial compatibility in marriage is important. Very important. Just like religious compatibility and social compatibility, financial compatibility matters. Actually, within the books of fiqh, it is one of the reasons the lady can absolutely refuse the person who's coming to ask for her hand, and the father as well. If he cannot have her live at the same standard the father is, then he does not have the right to ask for her hand. We like those movies where it's, yani, the poor guy asks for the... No, the poor guy shouldn't go ask for the lady who is living in a castle, because they don't tell us what happens after they get married. They end the movie there, conveniently. They end the movie when they get married. يا أخي, go 15 years later, when she's like, تضرب أنت وفقرك وأهلك وبيتك وعفنك. يعني this is, I'm living like a dog. My dad would take care of me. When she's fed up with him and his poverty and the lack of the standard of living that she's living, they don't show us that piece because it's not appropriate. If he is the provider, yeah, then he has to provide for her a living that is standard. The Shafi'i madhab and the Hanafi madhab, they specifically in their books point out that if she had a maid, he has to bring her a maid by word, like in the fiqh book, by word. If she had a maid in her house, he has to bring her one. And if he can't, then go look for someone who has financial. It's not people being better and lesser. No, it's an issue of compatibility because it makes no sense. If she lived like this all her life, why is it okay to expect that she's going to live much less than this for the rest of her life? To think that love is enough is, again, naive and dumb. And it's not worth the argument. It's really not worth a conversation outside of preschool and maybe any teenage groups. We're not going to have that as functioning adults. It's not enough. You need to actually have some plan where she's going to live. Or she's living in a house where she has a lot of wealth, but she's a minimalist by nature. Like, she's not living on much. Like, she's living in a very lavish, a very rich home and a castle, but she's not like that. She's a minimalist person where she doesn't want that wealth. She wants to live simplistically. That's a different story. But if this is what she's living and what she's used to, then you have to make sure there's some financial compatibility. That's why, and the concept of nafaqa, which is what I want to end with today, when he says, لِيُنْفِقْ ذُو سَعَةٍ مِّن سَعَتِهِ. This verse, the scholars did not understand it only for the concept of nafaqa during the iddah. Even though that's what obviously it's talking about. During the iddah, the man is responsible to take care of his wife. He has to put her in a house similar to his. She has to live similar to what she was living before. He has to take care of her financially, clothe her, feed her, and keep her safe. That's what he has to do during the 3 months of the iddah. And if she's pregnant, until the end of her pregnancy, he owes her that. But the concept of nafaqah in Islam is also important to marriage. Now, to go back to the default I talked to you about. When we talked about the default being, the man is the provider, his wealth, he makes it. It goes to his household to feed and clothe and put a roof on their house and take care of their needs. And the wife takes care of the household. But what about the wife herself? She gets something called a nafaqah. Islamically speaking, she gets a nafaqah, which is around roughly 10% of what the man makes. Roughly 10%, a little bit less, a little bit more, depending on the norm of the time. That wealth is not for her food or her clothing. No, that is just extra wealth that goes to her pocket so that she builds wealth. Now, if you come from a traditional Muslim background, go ask your father or your mother about this. They will tell you, the sheikh will tell you, this is an idiot. We've never heard this in all our lives. We've been living happy for 50 years. It's never been the case. And because people were living so poorly in the middle of the last century, meaning the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, when people got married, they were both dirt poor. They had nothing. So they built from the ground up, and all the money was put in one place, and everyone pulled out the money and felt it. It's fine. The problem with that system, the problem with it, is that what happens if a divorce occurs? And she's been at home taking care of the kids all this time, and he's been making wealth, and there's actually more wealth now than there was before. What does she get, aside from her mu'akhar of the mahr? Which the concept of mu'akhar, by the way, is not even an authentic Islamic idea. Mahr is one thing. Here's the mahr. Because people are poor, it's like, okay, you can't pay it all up once. Here, pay half of it up front, pay the next half throughout your life. Yeah, you owe it if you die, it's a dain, and if you divorce, you owe it to her at the end of the settlement, you owe it. But let's say there's no mahar. The mahar, what's the mahar of most, go back, if you're my age, ask what your mother's mahar was. Like what, I don't know, a feather and something has no wealth, nothing at all. So it's very simple. So when she gets divorced, asamahallah, then what happens? She ends up with nothing. Now the reason she's ending up with nothing is because the father, the husband, never gave her nafaqah. Because the wife is like, I don't need nafaqah, we're happy, alhamdulillah, I don't want to, I'm worried. No. You have to have, if you're not going to take the nafaqah, then that has to be something that's understood, is going to be calculated at the end of the marriage. So what the Canadian law does, or the American law does here, the Western law in terms of divorce, where they break it down 50-50, it's not that off of what Islamic law is. It's not that off. It's better than nothing. But it's not fair either. 50% is obviously a little bit too much, but for it to be nothing is, 50 is better than zero, because at least there's no dhulm actually occurring here. But the Islamic way is for there to be a nafaqah. The nafaqah roughly is 10% of what he makes. So if he makes 100,000, 10,000 goes to her. And that 90,000 is not his. That 90,000 is for the mortgage and the clothing and the food and the trips and all that stuff and whatever extra ends up in his pocket, which is usually nothing. Which is usually almost nothing. Right? The man, you end up with nothing. And that's just the norm of things. Unless you're a big earner, you're earning a lot, you're a tajir, you're making a lot of money, that's a different story. But for the majority of us, not much is going to be left. But that nafaqa is for her. Maybe how is she going to live if she ends up being divorced? Because if we don't make sure, if he doesn't get a nafaqa, then what happens is that her marriage to him becomes a leverage chip in his hand. He has a chip to bargain with now, that you have nothing. You've been married to me for 15 years. You have 3 kids that need you. You have no skills. You haven't been working for all these years. You have no money. I have all of it. So now you need me. And because you need me now, I will mistreat you. And that's not how it's supposed to be. That's not how it's supposed to be. Islamically, there's a nafaqa. There's a nafaqa that he owes her. If she's not working and she's not making her own money, even if she is, by the way, like even if she's working, right, and the money that she makes is hers, and the money that he makes is for the house, and she's taking care of the household with her work, with her own physical presence, and with her wealth, he still owes her a nafaqa. And that's a part of Islamic law. And this is not a disputable part of Islamic law where different madhab have different opinions. No, this is a fully agreed upon. It's just people don't do it because they were too poor. Like the guy was making barely enough money to feed him, her, and keep a roof over their heads. There was no space for nafaqa. Like you can't have nafaqa if the amount of money the man is making is not meeting basic needs. Right? If the amount the man is making is not meeting basic needs, then there's no place for nafaqa, obviously, because they're not making. But once they have more than their basic needs, then the nafaqa is a part of this agreement. If she's going to forfeit her nafaqa, then she has to be someone of wealth, or she's working herself. Meaning a lady can forfeit her nafaqa. She says, I don't want nafaqa from you, because she has her own wealth or she's working. But if she's not, what should happen at the end if there's a divorce that occurs is that it should be calculated, and it should be removed from his wealth and given to her. So, for example, they divorce, la samaha Allah, and he owes her maybe $2,000 from the mu'akhara of the mahr, they give her the $2,000. Okay? But she didn't work all throughout her marriage, and he didn't give her any nafaqa. It's not that hard. How long were you married for? 15 years. All right. How much did you make in the first year? I made 65,000. All right. What's 10% of that? 70. You calculate, and you give her that wealth. In my opinion, it's more fair than nothing, and it's more fair than dividing 50% of the wealth, especially if he's a big earner. Like people who are men who are making in the hundreds of millions of dollars, we have to be reasonable with what it is that people are getting. It's still percentage-wise, but Islam doesn't see it to be zero, as many of our marriages end these days, which is why a lot of women, like, I don't want an Islamic end of my marriage. The reason that they say that is because the nafaqa is not being talked about. Because we're not discussing this piece at the beginning. That she is owed a nafaqa. If she forfeits it, that's her choice. But she has to be she has to verbally forfeit it. She has to have some other way of making her own wealth. Or he has to be so poor that there's nothing, he's not making anything in addition to what's covering their basic needs. But if they're covering their basic needs, she is owed a nafaqa. And that's why I want to end with that piece, inshallah ta'ala, in terms of understanding. The rest of the verses in Surah Al-Talaq, which we'll recite, inshallah ta'ala, next week, are very spiritual. And the reason that they're spiritual and they're filled with warnings is because of the norm of the time. Meaning, the verses or the ahkam, the rulings that you listen to me talk about within this surah up till this moment, you're not able to actually appreciate them unless I explain to you what the norm of the time, what they were revealed, was. So when I explain to you next time the norm of the time, and then what these rulings did, you'll understand why these verses are like, you either follow this or you're going to be punished. Because that's not how the norm was. The norm was not, women did not get any of the rights that were explained in Surah Al-Talaq at all. So if you look at Surah Al-Talaq within these surahs in terms of the theme, it could be marriage or it could be the rights of women in Islam, which is why I think is probably even a better way to put it. I'll end with that, inshallah.